get so outraged when people use our office microwave and their freaking eggplant parmesan splatter sauce all over the back wall, and then they don't take the time to reach in and clean it all up, so the next five things that get heated up are essentially sprayed with the smell of your damn sauce.
Yeah, like those people at Macy's who try to spray our wrist with the new Taylor Swift Wonderstruck Enchanted fragrance. Those people piss me off.
Hey, slow your roll, Talarski. Let's stay with the microwave oven. It beeps when it's done, right? Then I open the door, and it continues to beep. I've opened the door. I'm here. There is no more effective way for me to tell the microwave that I've received its signal that it's done than me being present and opening the door. What is it trying to tell me? That it's backing up? I can't get behind that.
Well, at least you're not one of the people who sets the microwave for 4 minutes, heats up your lunch for 2 minutes and 33 seconds, and then leaves the remaining 1 minute and 37 seconds there on the timer. Like, I want to use their stupid leftover time.
Wait. I am one of those people. I think it's nice if the next person uses my time. Even if you only use a minute, there's 37 seconds left that maybe somebody else might use, and they don't have to press the button.
Oh, I hate that. It's dirty time. I don't want it, okay? When you're done, set it to zero.
Yep, you gotta start fresh.
Like, what do you think this is, a parking meter? I can't get behind that. Nobody needs your time. I'll choose my own time. That way, I can go use the bathroom while my lunch is microwaving.
Yeah, but then you're not back by the time your lunch is ready. I can't get behind that. What am I supposed to do? Wait or take your stupid lunch out?
Yeah, you know, I hate it when people take my lunch out. It's like you put your hands all over my food. That's my food. That's disgusting. I can't believe that they would even do that. It's not even your deal. Wait, you guys, there must be something more to life than just random outrage, right?
No, I don't think so. Not so much.
It's what keeps me going.
Huh. Me too. On the nose today, we'll talk about the way outrage fuels what's in the news. And now he gets really crabby when the Teletubbies smoke in his breezeway. Colin McEnroe.
I do. I don't like it. And they're supposed to be role models anyway. All right. So one of the things we concluded about today's nose is that a lot of the topics that we were looking at, and this is what we sometimes call in the nose the Papoulian through line, when Irene Papoulis is able to look at a whole bunch of fairly disparate topics and say, oh, no, they're all about X. And today it was outrage. So I'm going to tell you, first of all, who the nose panelists are. Then I'm going to tell you what some of the topics are. And then we're going to talk about outrage. A little bit later in the show, if we have time, some of us, I don't think Irene will participate so much in this, some of us may wish to also to discuss a less outrageous topic, the beards being grown by the Boston Red Sox. towards the end of the show, also, we're going to talk about some endorsements, some things that that we like that you might like, which, of course, we do every week. With us today is a food writer, film writer, fiction writer, every kind of writer, Rand Richards Cooper. And also Irene Papoulis, professor from Trinity College, professor from The Cut, a magazine for Connecticut's rapidly aging young adults. It's Teresa Kramer. We have sort of three topics we're going to run through really quickly here. But all of them do have to do with – they all have the effect of getting somebody really mad. So, Irene, since it's your Papoulian through line, explain what you were sort of seeing in these three topics. Or maybe in the news in general you see this.
Yeah, okay. It's just kind of the concept of outrage in general, I think, is foremost in my mind maybe is the Dave Chappelle incident. And a lot of people were outraged coming from various different directions. And so that just got me thinking about, for one thing, why I wasn't as outraged as a lot of people like Jacques Lamar, who was very outraged and he was there, were, and why that was. And so I just started to think about how there's a lot of things like that that I like to join. So I like to be outraged sometimes. I like to join with other people who are outraged in the same way I am. So one thing is it gives us a social connection to other people who are also outraged. It makes us feel that we can say, those other people are terrible, and therefore, because I'm not them, I'm better in some way. And it also has to do with the things that we – it's also very – I think you can really read people's outrage in terms of – as a way of understanding what their values are about things, you know, like so people that are maybe someone like me who likes who's interested in self-sabotage, who often feels I have maybe fear of success, resisting success, you know, all that. I look at Dave Chappelle and I can sort of, you know, I am Dave Chappelle's sort of lack of success in some ways, and people are outraged.
I like that as your T-shirt. I am Dave Chappelle's lack of success.
Perhaps a blog.
Yeah. Or I also like that as your Match.com ad. I'm interested in self-sabotage.
Yeah. So anyway, so I think as we talk about why we're outraged and who's outraged, I think it'd be interesting just to think about what that tells us about whoever's outraged.
Well, let me just tell you quickly about sort of the three items that we seized upon that in some way or another evoke outrage. And I'll tell them in a certain order. One of them has sort of been in the news this week. It's been page one news, I think, more than once in the Hartford Current subjects of editorials, too, and stuff like that. It involves the Newington Housing Authority and specifically a senior housing complex in Newington, where they implemented a no smoking policy. They actually implemented, I think, in 2011. But there's still one guy. He's 90 years old. He's a World War II veteran, and he won't do it. The non-smoking policy says you can't smoke inside your unit, and you have to get at least 10 feet away from the nearest first-floor window in order to smoke. He says, well, he's got some shrapnel wounds and stuff like that. It's hard for him to walk 10 feet away from the window, and he still wants to smoke.
Plus, he's 90 years old.
And he's 90 years old. Why R.J. Reynolds doesn't step forward and buy him a motorized wheelchair or anything, since he's living proof that you can live to be 90 years old despite your horrific smoking habit, I don't know. But anyway, this has sort of been, I think, the kind of outrage that triggered the kind of outrage that I think Irene's talking about when she sort of says it allows us to sort of divide up into groups. You know, a certain kind of group goes one way, a certain kind of group goes another way. We'll come back to that in just a second. Now, Rand called our attention to a headline in the estimable Journal of Ideas, the New York Post: rich Manhattan moms hire handicapped tour guides so kids can cut lines at Disney World. The headline kind of tells the whole story, but we'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along, as we tick through these two things. And then the story to which Irene was referring. We started off last week's notes with a lengthy discussion of the previous night's explosion on stage by Dave Chappelle. Maybe even explosion isn't the right word. Meltdown is the other word that gets used. That's not quite right either. But he didn't like the way the fans were talking back to him. He got mad. He stopped talking. He stood out on stage for about 35 minutes, I think, whatever his contractual allotted time was, reading a self-published book by a fan and smoking cigarettes and just being mildly, numbly antagonistic with the audience. Since then, he suggested that if North Korea drops a bomb anywhere in the United States, it should be in Hartford, and blamed the problems on young white alcoholics who, he said, constituted the large portion of the audience that was bothering him anyway. So meanwhile, there have been rejoinders since then, and Mayor Pedro Segarra has basically said, shut up and do your job and take some yoga classes. So a war of words has broken out. Lots of outrage there. But let's tick through them really quickly, and then we can sort of maybe, and as we do that, maybe we can sort of link them together and explore the overarching themes of outrage. And by the way, if you want to be part of any of this conversation, if you're that unwise, you can call 860-275-7266. You may tweet us. There's a special hashtag for today. It's hashtag NoseRage. You can tweet us at WNPR Colin. Hashtag NoseRage. But we'd love to have you on the air, too. 860-275-7266. We're going to start in Newington. You know, and this was one of these stories that I think sort of initially, anyway, everybody sort of looked at and went, well, the poor guy, he's 90 years old. He's a World War II veteran, highly decorated World War II veteran, does have shrapnel in his legs. You know, how many years does he have left? But he wants to smoke in the breezeway. He doesn't want to walk 10 feet away. I hear you over there snickering. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I read your post about it this morning on the blog, and I tend to agree with you in that he had a lot of opportunities to correct the situation, I guess my take on it is sort of you have to follow the rules, too. I mean, thank you for your service. That doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want for the rest of your life. Like, there are still rules. But it seems that if you're running an elderly housing unit, you're going to have a lot of people who aren't very mobile. And, there should just be a smoking lounge or something where these poor old guys can go walk into some room, you know, that's sort of attached to the building, and they don't have to stand outside in January to smoke their cigarette.
Of course, it sort of defeats the purpose of a no-smoking policy if you have a smoking lounge, but perhaps we can come back to that. I don't know. Anybody else want to touch this?
Where was the outrage? In two of these three instances, I'm not still sure where the general outrage
they're
was.
They're evicting this guy because he smoked 10, you know, in the breezeway. He was outside.
Are you outraged about that?
I find it kind of outraged. Yeah, I am kind of outraged.
Tell us about your outrage.
I think, you know, he's 90 years old. He wants to have a cigarette. He went outside. I mean, the breezeway, I guess it's sort of halfway outside, but it isn't in the house. Mm-hmm. And now he's evicted, and his wife, who has Alzheimer's, is evicted with him. I don't know if she was smoking, but
no, she was not.
She's also evicted just by association. And so where are they going to go?
Well, it's a good question, where they're going to go. Where are they going to go where they can smoke or where he can smoke? Because that's another part of all this. Just very quickly, just kind of because I did do a little bit of looking into this. And
you got a lengthy response of some...
From Melinda Harvey, who's the director of that housing authority. Yeah, basically, first of all, what the housing authority did, and it was the Board of Commissioners of the Housing Authority, and they said, you know what, we're going to have a non-smoking policy. And so 8 months were spent kind of just introducing the idea. The policy wasn't even put into effect, but there were newsletters and stuff like that. Then everybody signed a lease in which they effectively agreed to this non-smoking policy, which does say, now, there are a lot of places where you can't smoke at all on whatever the grounds are, the campus is. And those places sometimes include veterans' homes and veterans' hospitals. For example, if Mr. Nowicki wants to go to the Rocky Hill Veterans Home and Hospital, my understanding is that they are switching fairly soon to a non-smoking policy. You can't walk outside and smoke. You can't smoke anywhere on their grounds. I think at the Newington Veterans thing, it's like a 50-foot line you have to sort of maintain away from the buildings. Because part of there are a lot of issues here, including there are people who have oxygen tanks. This apparently, according to one account, includes Mr. Nowicki. But smoking around oxygen tanks, obviously not all that safe. You've got other people who have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. They don't want smoke coming in their windows and stuff like that. So the whole idea is get away from the windows. So, you know, there was an 8-month education period. Then they put in the policy. There's a lot of other people in this nursing home in this senior housing project who were also smokers. Some of them quit. Some of them complained and then quit. Some of them moved to other places so they could smoke because they didn't want to have to live with this policy. There were some other people who were kind of defiant about it. They were brought into line either through warnings or I think there were one or two other sort of things where they had to give them kind of legal stipulations saying this is the lease you sign. But, I mean, everybody else basically did find some way of accommodating themselves to this policy. And so if you say to this guy, oh, well, but you don't have to, what about all the other people who actually adjusted their lifestyles? What about them? They actually did something that they didn't want to do in many cases.
See, that's a perfect example of my theory. You know, like some people have this idea, you know, and I hate to generalize, but I think Connecticut people in general have this idea more than others. And I, as the only non-person who didn't grow up in Connecticut in this room, maybe I can say that. The idea that you should obey the rules. It's only fair. What if everybody did it? What if everybody broke the rule? Then life would be chaos. And we can't have chaos, so everybody has to obey the rules. So why should, you know, but I think, and I mean, of course, I'm sympathetic to that view to some extent. But at the same time, I think, you know, a lot of people, some people, I've seen smokers, you know, put plastic bags over smoke detectors so they can smoke in their house because they're not supposed to smoke in that house, let's say. And, you know, so some people kind of bend the rules, but they know how to do it. But the people who sort of want to go out there with their lack of obedience to the rules for whatever reason, you know, maybe, you know, everyone else isn't doing it. So it's just this one guy.
So when we get to Rand's story about the rich ladies hiring the handicapped guys so they don't have to wait in line at Disney World, you're kind of in favor of that, right? Because not everybody has to follow the rules.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that not everybody has to follow the rules. I'm just saying it's revealing to you, Colin, that you think, like, that's a value that you hold very, very high. I hold that value. I believe in that too, but maybe for me it's not as high on the list as it is for you.
All right, Rand is champing at the bit over there.
Well, I hope I can put this succinctly. I think most realities are drearily complicated, and the amount of language, Colin, that you required to just explain the background to and ramifications of this case, of this instance, of this problem, attest to how complicated it is. Mm-hmm. There are outrages in the foreground. There are larger outrages in the background. One of them might be, for instance,
nose rages.
Hashtag nose rages.
That generations of people were brought up systematically to be addicted to through a lot of withholding of pertinent medical and scientific information to be addicted to this devastating inhaled drug.
And we might even add that servicemen in World War II were given a lot of free cigarettes. They were given cartons of free cigarettes, just kind of almost a sop or a way of sort of saying, here,
right.
Steady your nerves with these.
So you have all the antecedent components necessary to sympathy. He served his country. He was given free cigarettes, presumably, or perhaps as part of his service. He was addicted, you know, willfully and ultimately woefully. He's an old man, and we have sympathy, and it's outrageous that this is being done to him. Well, until you look at all of these other factors, and these factors involve consequences for other people that are material, that are real, potential very dangerous consequences, the whole thing begins to get cloudy. Things that are ambiguous are burdensome. You want relief and you want clarity. Outrage is a great clarifier, and it's something that we seek in order to make things in certain instances easier for ourselves. And I think you can see this in certain ways in all three of the instances we've taken, and I would say even, interestingly, in the Disney one.
Oh, I can't wait for that. I certainly reject the notion that I am some wave-faced rule follower, and that Irene is this wild rebel. But I think,
although, you know, we do see that in her behavior.
In her behaviors.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, another thing that's missing from my explanation is that when in fact this guy started to run afoul of the rules, he was given a spoken warning, a written warning, and then there's something called a Kappa notice that you get, which is a prelude to getting a notice to quit, which is an eviction notice. And at all of those junctures, he's informed. I think it's standard policy in these situations to say, please come in and talk to us and, let's sort of figure out what's going on here. And at none of those junctures did he exercise that option.
So he was just completely silent the whole time?
From what I can tell now, I only really have the Housing Authority's version of this, but that's my understanding anyway, that what they typically do is say, all right, well, what do we have to do to get you 10 feet or more away from these windows? Do you need this? Do you need that? Do we need a ramp? What do you need? How can we get you to, because nobody likes to evict anybody. It's a real pain in the neck to evict somebody. It's much easier to figure out what it is that they want. They're going to wind up in court on September 17th. And, going to court is a huge pain in the neck. So, typically what you do is you sort of try to figure something out. And that never happened here.
And also, you would think if he's in the breezeway, he's already 3 feet. So he only has like seven more feet. He has to go. So is he being stubborn? I mean, maybe he feels like he wants to make a stand.
Could be.
Because he's outraged.
We need to go investigate. We need to do an on-premises investigation of how far he was exactly.
The nose eye team will be assembled. All right. So, by the way, if you want to chime in on these conversations, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. So let's tick through each of these, and then we could Irene can attempt some synthesis here towards the end. So, Rand, I'm going to place you in charge of this New York Post item, although I do have quite a bit of information here about it. But explain it once again, as you understand
it. It's very simple. You go to Disney World, you have to wait in long lines. And according to this article in the New York Post, some people have been circumventing this inconvenience by using a previously little-known service available at great cost that allows you to hire for the day a person in a wheelchair, an actual handicapped person who poses as a family member, and this allows you to go straight to the head of all the lines at Disney. Costs about $1,000 a day.
When I first came
across this, I sent it to Colin as, we should do a show on these 10 things automatically send you to hell after you die. So my initial reaction was instantly, one of outrage. It's on the face of it outrageous.
Now, since I, according to Irene, am leading a life of quiet desperation with a thinning briefcase of enthusiasms, I don't go to these places very much. But Teresa, genuine thrill seeker that she is, self-sabotaging thrill seeker that she is, does go to these places. Mm-hmm. So you at least can sort of give us a sense of you actually feel as though part of the problem is Disney's line system is stupid.
Well, yeah, I don't understand. For many years, Six Flags has had these, I think they call them Q-bots, and you can walk up to, you hold this little thing, and you walk up to the line, you scan it, and it says, okay, come back in an hour and a half, and you'll be at the front of the line. Why Disney doesn't have one of these? Yeah, so you can go smoke or gorge on cotton candy or whatever it is you do at Six Flags. Why, I can't understand why Disney wouldn't have one of these. You have to pay a lot of money to get one. It's like $50 or $100 or something, but less than renting a handicapped person for a day.
Which is $1,000 a day.
Yes.
But is it over the cost of the what regular people are paying
yes.
to wait in line?
Yep.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you get your ticket, and then I happened to get one. I was working at a paper at the time, and they kind of gave you one for free to try it out. And they are super – I mean, they're so convenient. They're really convenient. I can and the lines aren't anywhere near as bad at, you know, Riverside or Six Flags New England, whatever it wants to call itself now, as they are at Disney. But I have been to Disney with my grandmother, who was genuinely handicapped at the time, and been able to skip these lines, and it really was a wonderful thing.
Did your grandmother have any idea how much money she could have made?
Yeah.
You owed her $1,000 a day for that.
I feel like this is the market at work. This is deregulation.
Well, exactly. An economist will look at the fact of these lines and the fact that people in them are differently resourced and will say, here's a market, you know, that should be allowed to develop.
And that's all right, go on.
Well, I did a few weeks ago. I had to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles in Wethersfield, and a place of great collective public pain. And when I got there, I found that they had devised a new system of notification of what your wait is going to be since the last time I'd been there. There was a huge mob of people there, and you went and you were given a number, and then they have those boards where they flash the number, and you can see, you know, where you are given the numbers that are being served now. So I stayed for like 15 minutes, and I sort of did the math on how quickly the numbers were proceeding. I saw what my number was, and I figured I have a roughly 3-hour wait. Now, this filled me with just, you know, dread and fear and trembling. So my first thought was, you know, what if I just went up toward the front of the line and said, I'll give you $50 to trade your number, you know, for mine. And I wondered, you know, what price would work, A, and B, whether I would escape alive.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is something particularly enraging about people using resources to save themselves a time inconvenience. We accept variable pricing on all sorts of things. You know, seats in theaters and shows, those sections of the airplane where you never get to sit, where people are having massages and they're stretched out and, you know, drinking champagne. We accept all of that relatively placidly. But the idea that your time inconvenience is not going to be shared by someone else simply because they have the resource is, you know, really particularly enraging. And yet there I was, standing there in the DMV thinking, my next 3 hours of my life, they're kind of worthwhile to me. I'd pay for them. Here's a little market. I mean, I was like at least halfway conceptually there to being one of those Manhattan moms, you know, who the New York Post is stirring up this fanged populism, to mix a metaphor, you know, against.
The DMV especially is sort of like the great equalizer, that no matter who you are, you just have to put up with it. Unless, of course, you have like an assistant.
Yeah,
you can
I think
send
there are persisting
somebody.
Questions about that. I've had several different newspaper editors during my career at the Hartford Current who were obsessed with that and wanted somebody to do that story. And the answer, the example that was always brought up for some reason was, does Paul Newman have to wait in line? Or you now that he's gone, you can say David Letterman. Does David Letterman have to wait in line with Rand for 3 hours to get his license renewed? And there was always this kind of sense that couldn't possibly be true. But Irene, what were you going to say to all this?
First of all, I think David Letterman should wait in line, but it's connected to the fact that our society has, you know, if you have money, you can usually, people who have money are used to getting their way. So it's sort of, anyway, what I have to say is connected to what Rand said in the sense, but I think, you know, even on a plane, I feel annoyed when those first class people saunter on, you know, like, and I just have to sit here with the big, you know, and while we're talking about outrage, that also reminds me of when you're driving and there's a merge to the left and there's a line on the right for people turning right, but the people turn, you know, people zoom down that lane and then they try to cut in, you know, so that's also the same. That's a place where I think, that's where I'm really sort of one of those people that says it's wrong.
Okay, all right,
it's wrong to do that.
Let me ask a philosophical.
I have to respond to that though. Okay,
let me ask a philosophically framing question here. And you know, and then we can wrap this up. We'll go to break. We'll come back. We'll add the Dave Chappelle component to all this, and I hope we get to the beards too. But meanwhile, Diana tweets: doesn't Disney have some kind of queue system? I swear they did when I went in 2001. We don't know. We're not experts on that. So here's my philosophically framing question: is there a difference between seeking a privilege that exists somehow and seeking one that really doesn't exist? So, for example, you know, the airplane, they have a system, and if you pay $60 more, you can get a little bit more legroom. You pay, like, a lot more money, you know, you get champagne and caviar. That's a system. It exists. You know what it is, and then you decide or are forced by necessity to either exercise it or not, whereas the person speeding down the left-hand lane is seeking an advantage that really doesn't exist. The person who hires a handicapped person so that they can get in to the rides without waiting in line is seeking an advantage that doesn't really exist. They're manufacturing one that other people don't even know about, wouldn't even suspect existed. But I'm asking rather than saying, is there any kind of difference between those two things?
Well, in the Disney line, they're inventing a means that is hidden and other people don't know it, and they're paying a premium dollar for it. It would not be available even if it were openly advertised at the prices, at these prices. Mm-hmm. Almost no one in that line would avail him or herself of it. The person who is speeding along in that lane is doing something that theoretically any person can do, mm-hmm. but there's an unspoken categorical imperative that suggests that if we all try to do this, mm-hmm. no one will be able to, chaos will ensue, and therefore each one of us takes upon himself or herself, you know, that suppression of that desire in order to promote the general welfare. The person who doesn't do that incites your rage in a frankly political way. And by the way, I never knew that you went around with so much ready outrage. Yeah, you know, one wouldn't know that.
2 seconds ago, she was all in favor of being this maverick who doesn't follow the rules. Now,
but I just want to say,
you're zooming past her Prius. Yeah.
The perfect place to test yourself on this traffic thing, the perfect place, is on I-84 East coming into the city. The entrance ramp from 46 Sisson Avenue continues for a very long way and eventually becomes the off-ramp for Asylum Avenue and Capitol Avenue. Mm-hmm. And those two right-hand lanes are never occupied. At rush hour, the left-hand lanes that are on I-84 East are totally packed. Now, if you enter on Sisson Avenue and you stay in that right lane, after a certain point, people can't tell whether you've come all the way from Sisson Avenue or whether you've just gotten on from one of the subsequent entrances. In other words, you can go out there and no one knows whether one can accuse you. No one can give you that look of outrage because they don't know that you didn't just get on from the subsequent on-ramp.
That was really complicated. All right, we have to take a break. Okay. If we're going to get to Dave Chappelle, we got to take a break and we'll come back.
Shows on TV and 12 minutes of advertising. I can't get behind that kind of time. Eat quickly, drive faster, make more money now. I can't get behind that. My kids say, he said to me and I'm like, and he's like, and she's like, it's all he's all, she's all. I can't get behind that kind of
And we're back. It's a day of nose rage. We're talking about things that outrage people and possibly outrage us. And just so I don't forget to say it, one of the things that does outrage me is the culpability of the press in all this. I mean, I feel as though the Hartford Courant, which is sort of my mothership newspaper, has handled that whole Newington situation in such a way as to inflame what is essentially a pretty small-time beef at a public housing authority in Newington. But you would think it was Syria the way they're reporting it. So, and I think there's a lot of that going on here. Now, whether or not that's the case with Dave Chappelle is a whole other situation. Now, just to refresh, just to bring you up to date, so Dave Chappelle was here last Thursday night, not last night, but last Thursday night, and he had a bad encounter with his audience, and so much so that he really essentially stood on stage and refused to perform. Since then, he has been using this incident, which became a national story. He's been using that incident in his act. And so, I mean, he's been saying if North Korea were to drop a bomb in the United States, I hope it lands in Hartford, Connecticut. He's talked a little bit about the similarities and differences between himself and Michael Richards, formerly known as Kramer, who had his own meltdown on a similar comedy stage. He has complained about the suburban torturers, a room full of white people and young white alcoholics. He has made it racial, and he's stirred up people yet again. So I don't even know exactly. Well, actually, Teresa, one thing that you said as we were all emailing about this mm-hmm. is that somehow or other this also is an argument about privilege.
Well, yeah. I think Dave Chappelle, long before this ever happened, had a problem with sort of the young white alcoholic audience that he had cultivated sort of unintentionally. And that was part of why he walked away from his show. He felt more that there were all these bros that Colin did a show on who loved him. And he was not sure they were taking his comedy in the way that it was meant. And that maybe they were laughing at him and not with him to some degree. And so I think he is sort of annoyed at the privilege of these suburban kids who are demanding that he perform. And at the same time, the audience members are angry about the fact that they paid for something and they didn't get what they paid for. And it's all just one big privileged mess. Everybody's mad at everybody else's privilege because, I mean, Dave Chappelle's complaints seem pretty small when you consider he walked away, was it $39 million? That you have a hard time caring what he's mad about.
But why did he walk away? You know, I mean, I think the that's when he first got my attention was when I heard about that, whenever that was. That was quite a while ago when he walked away from his show. Mm-hmm. And I felt really sympathetic to him at the time because I felt like there's something about, you know, sort of being part of this sort of entertainment machine that he was very uncomfortable with, that made him feel that, you know, who am I and what exactly am I doing and why am I doing it? So that made him walk away and go to South mm-hmm. Africa. And, you know, and so I felt really sympathetic to that to him. So mm-hmm. and in a way, it seems like there was an echo of that in what happened in Hartford, too. You know, that there's something he has some kind of ambivalence or something about the idea of, you know, his role as a performer. I mean, of course, you could say,
I would agree on the show that he walked away. His he was ambivalent about it all. He wasn't particularly happy with the way things were going. He left. But he's made a choice to come back now. He didn't have to do that. He certainly made enough money. He lives on a farm in like North Carolina or somewhere, Ohio, something like that. He could go on milking sheep or goats or whatever he does all day. And he doesn't have to be back on the stage. And if he's going to do that, you just accept you've made a decision to come back as a performer after clearly putting a lot of thought into it. Why are you complaining?
Thanks to something that mm-hmm. Irene said, let me just bring this up and I want to hear what Rand has to say, but I have a different perspective on this than I had last week when we talked about it. By the way, if you want to be part of this conversation, 860-275-7266. Patrick from Niantic also has an overarching thing that he wants to say about this. We'll try to get to that. Also, people are communicating with us very actively about Disney's line system, which they feel that none of us really completely understands. There is something there called a fast pass, which I actually did read about in the article that Rand flagged us to. But I think the fast pass costs us like $310 to $380 for the VIP guide
per
and
hour,
fast per hour
oh
per fast.
God.
Pass. So,
ka-ching.
So anyway, you know, Irene sent us this one thing from Slate about this Chappelle incident, and then it linked to some Chappelle videos, including one where he's talking. This is from the past, pre-Hartford, where he's talking about the Michael Richards Kramer onstage meltdown. And at one point, he does this whole thing. He goes, and people probably do that with me because he goes, you know, I'm not very tightly wrapped. You know, I'm not very tightly wrapped. And so anything could happen. And then he compares it to Siegfried and Roy with the tiger. And he said, people come to be there the night the tiger attacks. So if I came unglued here, that'd be a good night for you because it'll be the night the tiger attacks Siegfried and Roy. People like that. And you know, watching that, and that was all done maybe even years ago, this bit, I thought, you know, it suggests to me there's a certain amount of calculation in all this. And, mm-hmm. you know, his hero, his mentor, the guy whose shadow he lives in, I don't know if he's really a mentor, but the shadow, he lives in the shadow of Richard Pryor, who would never go on stage and say, I'm not all that tightly wrapped, because he didn't need to say that about himself. It's like Jesse James saying, you know, I'm a desperado. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have to say that, probably it's not even really true. Mm-hmm. But for Richard Pryor, it was true. His meltdowns were famous. There were just times he came unglued. He couldn't perform. He tried to do his act backwards. He just, you know, drunkenly and druggedly assail his audience. And that's part of the whole Richard Pryor legend and cachet. And I feel as though Chappelle is trying to appropriate that for himself without thank God for Dave Chappelle, living it. You know, I mean, for Richard, it was this real problem that had a million different demons and led to him running down the street on fire. You know, you don't want that for anybody else. But I feel as though Chappelle, there's some calculation here. He kind of wants to be that guy who's not that tightly wrapped and whose explosions become the thing of legend.
Well, you know what? But this is, it wasn't explosive is no, sort of what I think about it.
No.
It was boring. You know, it was like, I'm just going to sit here and do nothing. If I had been in the audience, I would have been annoyed at the people around me for ruining my experience. I would have been annoyed at him, and I would have preferred that he flipped out on the audience and yelled at them, because at least that would have been entertaining.
Rand, I don't know how tuned you have been into the Dave
Well,
Chappelle
Dave Chappelle
song.
Belongs to the drearily large category for me of cultural phenomena that I read about or have read about but don't actually know firsthand. So the first time I've ever saw his any bit of his act or his show was the 8 minute and 30 second YouTube video from a handheld camera of the Hartford event. I completely agree that there was nothing dramatic or high pitched about it. It seemed to me, just at least the 8 minutes I watched, a comedian treading water and, you know, sort of aimlessly making this or that joke, some of which were laughed at. I didn't sense any particular animus in the crowd. It was all very innocuous. To me, the only outrageous thing in this is the implication, or at least the inference I made, that he was actually only contractually required to do about a half hour of routine,
yeah.
And presumably, you know, making God knows how much money, and tickets were very expensive. I have a readily available outrage, you know, like most citizens in the United States do, and it arises out of simple envy, like, how can figure X, baseball player, politician giving a speech, comedian giving a half hour, make dollars Y? That's outrageous. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
That's a whole another branch of this topic.
Yeah,
but
that's
I would
nose-rageous.
Say
nose-rageous.
That is nose-rageous. But I would just say this. Stand-up comedy is a particularly fraught transaction with an audience. And it places performer and audience in an ambiguous relationship of, you know, where lots of things are possible that aren't possible in other kinds of performances. This is what gives it its crackling electricity. And as a stand-up performer, you have to not only expect that, you embrace it, you thrive in it. It's difficult. It's weird. You know, hey, he had a bad night. He couldn't do it, didn't want to do it, and decided not to do it. And that decision is probably more likely to happen, sadly, in a place in a market like Hartford, because it's easier to get away with it.
I just want to say, the other thing about this was, as meltdowns go, or as whatever you're going to call this, mm-hmm. It was unimpressive. And my attention was drawn to a piece reminding me, there's a comic named Bill Burr, he's a white comic. He's much admired by other comedians. They all think this guy's great. He had a really bad night a few years ago in Philadelphia where the audience had turned. It was a similar situation, a whole bunch of comics. The audience had turned against a comedian named Dom Herrera who'd been on right before him. He came out and he had this very, very hostile audience to deal with. And he improvised this 10-minute tirade against Philadelphia, almost none of which I can quote, in which he insults cheesesteaks, every home sports team, and expresses a desire to stick the Liberty Bell up Ben Franklin's hiney. And I can give you a little bit of it with some words change. Rocky's your freaking hero. The pride of your whole city is built around a guy who doesn't even exist. Joe Frazier is from here, but he's black, so you can't freaking deal with him. So you built a statue after a 3-foot-tall freaking Italian, you stupid cheese-eating jackasses. This has become this kind of legendary thing where, I mean, he took this terrible situation and did this unbelievably hostile
tirade.
And I think
the audience loved it.
And we would love to be abused by that.
Yeah, it's really funny. Yeah. But I don't think Chappelle belongs in the same category. I mean, he just sulked, basically.
But some of his humor is extremely hilarious, and his physical humor is great, you know, and so he has a lot of really, really good humor, and so that's why I don't think it was calculated. I think it was, you know, there's a vulnerability. If a person is vulnerable, what happens? Is there a way to be vulnerable in public like that? You know, most people don't do it, but, you know, he did.
I'm trying to think whether I can dare take a call here. Let's say Patrick's been on hold, and I think he has an overarching, not necessarily Chappelle-related comment, and then we're going to have to move on because we have to get to our endorsements. All right. Go ahead, Patrick.
Hi. Just about how this whole conversation is kind of wrapped around privilege, even in the comedian's sake, like that, it's their act, it's their privilege. I mean, it is you have to be responsible with what you say, but to do whatever they want, that's their privilege. And what you were saying before about how asking for a privilege that doesn't really exist, or one that does exist, it seemed like if you go to the point where asking for the privilege that doesn't exist, like going to the front of the line with a handicapped person in at Disneyland, it would seem like almost if that continued on and became a big thing, almost like you would have to be worried about exploitation of a handicapped person. Because, I mean, I work with special needs youngsters, and that's one thing that's always on my mind. It has to be. And so it's just when you're asking for something that for a permission for a privilege that really doesn't exist, seems like you're going to be doing harm, not just to yourself, but to other people. Like you could be endangering others instead of just yourself, especially with the guy cutting in and when the lane is ending, which is another one of my pet peeves.
All right, listen, thanks for your call. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We'll have time for endorsements, things that will make you happy instead of making you outraged.
Street, some punk's chopped off his hair. I'm the only one who stops to see if he's dead. Turns out he's dead, and that's why I'm singing. Why is wrong?
Another thing I really hate is when I'm in the kitchen cooking and there's a 6-foot-tall blue and green guinea pig with Khloe Kardashian's face looking over my shoulder the whole time. That's a hallucination? Never mind. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Lamar Odom. On Monday's show, the barely acknowledged world of asexuals. And now, back to Colin.
There actually is there's a whole community of people who consider themselves asexual. They have normal emotional lives, but they do not express those emotions through sex. They don't they consider it a sexual orientation. You're going to learn more about them on Monday. Only we would do the show, of course. Okay, it's time for endorsements, things that might, in fact, inspire you to feel better about life instead of worse, the way the rest of our show did. So let's start with Teresa Kramer.
Well, it's September, so I want to endorse apple fritters. They are my favorite fall time goodie. And a website that I've been obsessed with for the past 3 days. It's called 40 Days of Dating, in which these two friends decide to date each other for 40 days and write about it every day. And just today they posted day 40. I'm on day 39. I have no idea whether or not they're still together. And they take a trip to Disney. And there is no mention of renting any handicapped people.
All right. Yeah. Good endorsements. What have you got for us, Irene?
Last Friday night, I was in Collinsville, Connecticut, at this art show.
Colin founded that place.
Colin founded it. Yeah, it's his town.
It was founded in honor of me.
And my boyfriend and I happened into the LaSalle Market, and they were having this, apparently what they have every night. Mm-hmm. So they'll have it tonight, too, an open mic. And people were, it was a very interesting mixed crowd. I saw some people, I saw this English major from Trinity who was singing, and it was just a relaxed atmosphere and really nice. And I saw the guy that does the Myers-Briggs, Paul Teeger, he was playing guitar up on stage, and it was just a delightful evening. So if you want to go out tonight and just hang out and listen to people play music, that some of whom you might know, it's the LaSalle Market in Collinsville.
Open mic. All right. Great endorsement. What have you got?
I'm going to endorse two things. One, jokingly, because we didn't cover it, a set of razors for the Boston Red Sox. They're growing these weird beards. They look like a bunch of Amish farmers. I think of them as these Amish all-stars. So I don't know why they are choosing to look like Mennonites, but I don't like the look. It's actually making me like the Yankees for being clean cut.
Although, can we pause? We actually have a minute or two where we can talk a little bit about this. So the backstory to this, Teresa, you have a quick theory about why they're growing beards.
Well, I think it's because they're being the anti-Yankees, because when Johnny Damon left, they made him clean his act up, and now so they're like, well, we're going to look as disgusting as possible so that when you guys are all put together, we don't mix.
But Damon's beard and hair looked great. The whole effect was one of, like, you know, savage handsomeness. These guys, like where's the plow?
He looked, yeah. Damon looked like the Neanderthal in the Geico commercials.
Yes.
And these guys do. They do look like Mennonites. Now, the backstory to this is kind of interesting, even to people who don't care that much about baseball. For the last 2 years, the Red Sox have had a toxic clubhouse atmosphere. You know, people don't like each other. People don't get along. People don't pardon me, Irene Papoulis, follow the rules. They don't pull together. It's every man for himself. And one of the things that happened this year was several players who were brought in, not necessarily because of their titanic ability. They're like okay, good players, but because they are famously good clubhouse guys. Two of them are Mike Napoli and Johnny Gomes. The two of them got together on this beard thing, and they started growing their beards really? Together. Johnny Gomes actually says that sometimes when Napoli's at the plate, his kids are watching TV, and they think it's daddy, because these beards are so big and face-obscuring that you just can't tell people apart. And more of the Red Sox started to grow. And it became this kind of fun, solidarity-provoking thing. There's now even a little mini tradition when somebody hits a home run, sometimes somebody else in the dugout will, in a celebratory way, pull on his beard.
Plus, they get to do a ZZ Top imitation tour.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the beards, I think, have been kind of a nice thing this season. Anyway, continue with your endorsements.
Second thing, seriously, that I'm endorsing is a book called The Republic of Noise by a writer I wasn't familiar with named Diana Senechal, S-E-N-E-C-H-A-L, The Republic of Noise. It's one of these books that's very hard to describe in three sentences because it ranges into very many areas. But in essence, it's a meditation on the meaning and the utility of solitude, of time by yourself, with yourself, to think and to read. That's surprising that it's about that, because it is actually a book about schools and school reform. She feels and argues in this book that the conditions of our contemporary American life are very hostile to solitude, and that the regimens of and pedagogies of our schools these days are also inimical to a certain kind of solitudinous learning that has to do with literature, reading books, and the development of the whole human. So it's a cautionary book, but it's a book that ranges very widely through literature, memoir, and school issues of school reform. It's a great book, The Republic of Noise.
So I'm going to endorse something that Irene actually endorsed a long time ago, and so I'm a late arrival. She was an early adopter. And that is a place in West Hartford Center called Cafe Sophia, which is this kind of nice little coffee shop place that's run by, I'm going to say, Armenians probably. But I'm going to endorse something more than that,
maybe
too.
Maybe Bulgarians.
It could be Bulgarians.
They are Armenians.
I think they are Armenians. And they have really nice coffee and nice pastries. But, you know, the other thing is it's not Starbucks. And I love Tessane. I love Cafe Sophia. I encourage people to go to coffee shops that are not owned by big chains. I mean, Starbucks isn't a bad thing or anything, but they're just local places that have some real character. I'm sure Teresa on the cut can put up the names of six or seven others, or JoJo's downtown or whatever. And also, I like the idea of us going to these coffee shops and having the kinds of conversations that we have here on The Nose, where people talk about things that outrage them or things that they like. I feel like Irene and Luis Figueroa and I were all in Paris together, actually, for one glorious night. But this summer, you know, Rand's a great fan of Berlin and other German cities, where there are these, you know, people sit around drinking coffee and talking about stuff, you know, with no real purpose, no real agenda. You know, solitude and silence are a great way to learn, but so is sort of the free exchange of ideas in someplace like a coffee shop. So I'm not only endorsing Cafe Sophia, I'm endorsing, you know, gather with like-minded or non-like-minded people into these places and have lively conversations and spend some of your weekend or your weekday free time that way. I'm also going to endorse The Throwaways of Saul Goodman. Saul Goodman is a character on Breaking Bad. He's played by the comedian Bob Odenkirk. There's talk of a spinoff series when Breaking Bad is over that would just be about Saul. That might be too much. It might be pulling the plant up from its garden. But he's, you know, some of these have to be improvised. A couple of weeks ago, the character Jesse Pinkman lit up a joint in Saul's office, and Saul, you know, was appalled by that. And at one point, he went, "Hey, Mr. Natural." Well, Mr. Natural is a reference to this mostly long forgotten R. Crumb character with a big, long Mike Napoli Red Sox type beard. And you know, there are all these little sort of Easter eggs that, you know, that are just thrown in with Saul's. And you're usually so tense and so worried that someone's going to get killed because it's Breaking Bad that there's almost no time to enjoy these little throwaways. But they are absolutely wonderful.
It's a great performance by that actor. I mean, he raises sort of sniveling self-interest to a principal.
I would also quickly endorse, since we talked about the Red Sox, the commentaries of Dennis Eckersley, who has replaced Jerry Remy, who's had to leave because of this horrible family tragedy. Dennis Eckersley is so much fun to listen to. I mean, I loved Jerry Remy, but I'm enjoying Dennis Eckersley so much. He has his own language of humps and cheese and hooks and stuff like that. So anyway, we're done. Thanks to Rand. Thanks to Irene. Thanks to Teresa. We'll be back on Monday.
radio, baby. You and me talking, laughing down on college back and roll. I see you on the
radio. I'm Kyone Wolf, and I personally agree with that bumper sticker. If you're not outraged, then you're not paying a... Ooh, a squirrel. Look at its tail. Squirrels.